struggled for them.
That is true, said Simon. Then he asked, Do you remember that day when we met on the road to Nidaros? You were sitting in the grass, nursing Nokva. Kristen nodded. Could you have done for that child at your breast what my sister did for her son? Given him away to those who were better able to provide for him? Kristen shook her head. But ask his father to forget what you may have said to him in anger. Do you mean that you're unable to do that for him and your six other fair sons? To tell your husband that the young lads need him to come home to them, to his own manor?
I will do as you ask, Simon,
said Kristen softly. After a moment she continued,
You have used harsh words to tell me this.
In the past you've also chastised me more sternly than any other man has.
Yes.
But now I can assure this will be the last time. His voice had that teasing, merry ring to it that it used to have. No, don't weep like that, Kristen. But remember, my sister, that you have made this promise to a dying man. Once again, the old, mirthful glint came into his eyes. You know, Kristen, it's happened to me before that I learned you weren't to be counted on. Hush now, my dear, he implored a little later. He had been lying there listening to her piteous, broken sobs. You should know that I remember you were also a good and loyal sister. We will remain friends to the end, my Kristen. Toward evening, he asked them to send for the priest. Sira Eirik came, heard his confession, and gave him the last oil in viaticum. He took leave of his servants and the sons of Erlan, the five who were home. Kristen had sent Nokva to Kruka. Simon had asked to see Kristen's children, to bid them farewell. On that night, Kristen again kept vigil over the dying man. Toward morning, she dozed off for a moment. She woke up to a strange sound. Simon lay there, moaning softly. It distressed her greatly when she heard this, that he should complain, as quietly and pitifully as a miserable abandoned child, when he thought no one would hear him. She leaned down and kissed his face many times. She noticed that his breath and his whole body smelled sickly and of death. But when daylight came, she saw that his eyes were lively and clear and steadfast. She could see that he suffered terrible pain when Jon and Sigurd lifted him up in a sheet while she changed his bed, making it as soft and comfortable as she could. He had refused any food for more than a day, but he was very thirsty. After she had gotten him settled, he asked her to make the sign of the cross over him, saying, Now I can't move my left arm anymore either. But whenever we make the sign of the cross over ourselves, or over anything that we want to protect with the cross, then we must remember how the cross was made sacred and what it means, and remember that with the suffering and death of the Lord, this symbol was given honor and power. Simon remembered that he had once heard this read aloud. He wasn't used to thinking about much when he made the sign of the cross over his breast or his houses or possessions. He felt ill-prepared and not ready to take leave of this earthly home. He had to console himself that he had prepared himself as best he could in the time he had, through confession. And he had been given the last rites. Romborg. But she was so young. Perhaps she would be much happier with a different man. His children? May God protect them. And Geird would look out for their welfare with loyalty and wisdom. And so he would have to put his trust in God, who judges a man not according to his worth, but through his mercy. Later that day, Sigrid Andra's daughter and Germund of Kruka arrived. Simon then asked Kristen to leave and take some rest, now that she had been keeping watch and tending to him for such a long time. And soon, it will be quite vexing to be around me, he said with a little smile. At that, she broke into loud sobs for a moment. Then she leaned down and once again kissed his wretched body, which was already starting to decay. Simon lay in bed quietly. The fever and pain were now much less. He lay there thinking that it couldn't be much longer before he would be released. He was surprised that he had spoken to Kristen as he had. It was not what he had intended to say to her. But he had not been able to speak of anything else. There were moments when he felt almost annoyed by this. But surely the festering would soon reach his heart. A man's heart is the first thing to come alive in his mother's womb, and the last thing to fall silent. Surely it would soon fall silent inside him. That night his mind rambled. Several times he screamed loudly, and it was terrible to hear. Other times he lay there, laughing softly and saying his own name, or so Kristen thought. But Sigrid, who sat bending over him, whispered to her that he seemed to be talking about a boy, their cousin, who had been his good friend when they were children. Around midnight he grew calm and seemed to sleep. Then Sigrid persuaded Kristen to lie down for a while in the other bed in the room. She was awakened by a commotion in the room. It was shortly before daybreak, and then she heard that the death struggle had begun. Simon had lost his voice, but he still recognized her. She could tell by his eyes. Then it was as if a piece of steel had broken inside them. They rolled up under his eyelids. But for a moment he lay there, still alive, a rattling sound in his throat. The priest had come, and he said the prayers for the dying. The two women sat next to the bed, and the entire household was in the room. Just before midday, Simon finally breathed his last. The next day, Geird Dara came riding into the courtyard at Formo. He had ridden a horse to exhaustion along the way. Down at Brighton, he had learned of his brother's death, so at first he seemed quite composed. But when his sister, weeping, threw her arms around his neck, he pulled her close and began to sob like a child himself. He told them that Romborg Lavrun's daughter was at Diefrin with a newborn son. When Gauta Erlundsson brought them the message, she had shrieked at once that she knew this would be the death of Simon. Then she fell to the floor with birth pains. The child was born 6 weeks early, but they hoped he would live. A magnificent funeral feast was held in Simon Andresen's honor, and he was buried right next to the cross at the Olav Church. People in the parish were pleased that he had chosen his resting place there. The ancient Formo lineage, which had died out with Simon Simonsson on the male side, had been mighty and grand. Astrid Simon's daughter had made a wealthy marriage. Her sons had borne the title of knight and sat on the royal council, but they had seldom come home to their mother's ancestral manor. When her grandson decided to settle on the estate, people thought it was almost as if the old lineage had been revived. They soon forgot to think of Simon Andresen as a stranger, and they felt great sorrow that he had died so young, for he was only 42 winters old. Chapter 5. Week after week passed, and Kristen prepared herself in her heart to take the dead man's message to Erlon. There was no doubt that she would do it, but it seemed to her a difficult task. In the meantime, so much had to be done at home on the estates. She went about arguing with herself about postponing it. At Whitsuntide, Romborg Lavrun's daughter arrived at Formo. She had left her children behind at Diefrin. They were well, she said when Kristen asked about them. The two maidens had wept bitterly and mourned their father. Andres was too young to understand. The youngest, Simon Simonsson, was thriving, and they hoped he would grow up to be big and strong. Romborg went to church to visit her husband's grave a couple of times. Otherwise, she never left her manor. But Kristen went south to see her as often as she could. She now sincerely wished that she had known her sister better. The widow looked like such a child in her mourning garb. Her body seemed fragile and only half-grown in the heavy, dark blue gown. The little triangle of her face was yellow and thin, framed by the linen bands beneath the black woolen veil, which fell in stiff folds from the crown of her head almost to the hem of her skirts. And she had dark circles under her big eyes, the coal-black pupils wide and always staring. During the hay harvest, there was a week's time when Kristen couldn't get away to see her sister. From the harvesters, she heard that a guest was visiting Romborg at Formo, Jamal Talvertsen. Kristen remembered that Simon had mentioned this man. He owned an exceedingly large estate not far from Diefren, and he and Simon had been friends since childhood. A week into the harvest, the rains came. Then Kristen rode over to see her sister. Kristen sat talking about the terrible weather and about the hay, and then asked how things were going at Formo. All of a sudden, Romborg said, "Jan will have to manage things here. I'm heading south in a few days, Kristen." "Yes, you must be longing for your children, poor dear," said Kristen. Romborg stood up and paced the floor. "I'm going to tell you something that will surprise you," the young woman said after a moment. "You and your sons will soon be invited to a betrothal feast at Diefren. I said yes to Jamalt before he left here, and Geird will hold the wedding." Kristen sat without saying a word. Her sister stood staring at her, pale and dark-eyed. Finally, the older sister spoke. "I see that you won't be left a widow for very long after Simon's death. I thought you mourned him so grievously. But you can make your own decisions now." Romborg did not reply. After a moment, Kristen asked, "Does Geert Dara know that you intend to marry again so soon?" "Yes." Romborg began pacing again. "Helga advises me to do so. Jamalt is rich." She laughed. "And Geert is such a clever man that he must have seen long ago that our life was so wretched together, Simon's and mine."
"What are you saying?"
"No one else has ever noticed that your life together was wretched," Kristen said after a pause. "I don't think anyone has ever seen anything but friendship and goodwill between the two of you. Simon indulged you in every way, gave you everything you wished for, always kept in mind your youth, and took care that you should enjoy it and be spared toil and travail. He loved his children and showed you every day that he was grateful to you for giving birth to the two of them." Romborg smiled scornfully. Kristen continued fiercely, "If you have any cause to think that your life wasn't good together, then surely Simon is not to blame."
"No," said Romborg. "I will bear the blame, if you do not dare."
Kristen sat there, dumbfounded.
"I don't think you know what you're saying, sister," she replied at last.
"Yes, I do," said Romborg. "But I can believe that you might not know. You've had so little thought for Simon that I'm convinced this may be new to you. You considered him good enough to turn to whenever you needed a helper who would gladly have carried red-hot iron for your sake. But never did you give any thought to Simon Andresen or ask what it might have cost him. I was allowed to enjoy my youth, yes. With joy and gentleness, Simon would lift me up into the saddle and send me off to feasts and merriment. With equal joy and gentleness, he would welcome me when I came back home. He would pat me the way he patted his dog or his horse. He never missed me while I was gone."
Kristen was on her feet. She stood quietly next to the table. Romborg was wringing her hands so the knuckles cracked, pacing back and forth in the room.
"Jamalt," she said in a calmer voice, "I've known for years how he thought of me. I saw it even while his wife was still alive. Not that he ever gave himself away in word or deed, you mustn't think that. He grieved for Simon too, and came to me often to console me. That much is true. It was Helga who said to both of us that now it would be fitting if we... And I don't know what I should wait for. I will never find more consolation or any less than I feel right now. I want to try living with a man who has been silently thinking of me for years on end. I know all too well what it feels like to live with a man who is silently thinking about someone else."
Kristen didn't move. Romborg stopped in front of her, with her eyes flashing.
"You know what I say is true."
Kristen left the room without a word,
her head bowed. As she stood in the rain outside in the courtyard, waiting for the servant to bring her horse, Romborg appeared in the doorway. She stared at her sister with dark and hateful eyes. Not until the next day did Kristen remember what she had promised Simon if Romborg should marry again. She rode back to Formo. This was not an easy thing for her to do. And the worst of it was that she knew there was nothing she could say that would give her sister any help or solace. This marriage to Yamalt of Alin seemed to her a rash decision when Romborg was in such a state of mind. But Kristen realized that it would do no good for her to object. Romborg was sullen and morose and answered her sister curtly. Under no circumstances would she allow her stepdaughter to go to Urengard. Things at your estate are not such that I would think it advisable to send a young maiden over there. Kristen replied meekly that Romborg might be right about that, but she had promised Simon to make the offer.
If Simon, in his feverish days, didn't realize that he was offending me when he made this request of you, then surely you should realize that you offend me by mentioning it, said Romborg,
and Kristen had to return home without accomplishing her goal. The next morning promised good weather, but when her sons came in for breakfast, Kristen told them they would have to bring in the hay without her. She had a mind to set off on a journey, and she might be gone several days.
I'm thinking of going north to Dovre to find your father, she said. I intend to ask him to forget the discord that has existed between the two of us, to ask him when he will come home to us.
Her sons blushed. They didn't dare look up, but she could tell they were glad. She pulled Munan into her arms and bent her face down to look at him.
You probably don't even remember your father, do you, little one?
The boy nodded mutely with sparkling eyes. One by one, the other sons cast a glance at their mother. Her face looked younger and more beautiful than they had seen it in many years. She came out to the courtyard some time later, dressed for travel in her church attire. A black woolen gown trimmed with blue and silver at the neck and sleeves, and a black sleeveless hooded cloak, since it was high summer. Nokva and Gauta had saddled her horse as well as their own. They wanted to go with their mother. She didn't voice any objections. But she said little to her sons as they rode north across Rost Gorge and up toward Dovre. For the most part, she was silent and preoccupied. If she spoke to the young lads, it was about other things, not about where they were going. When they had gone so far that they could look up the slope and glimpse the rooftops of Haugen against the horizon, she asked the boys to turn back. You know full well that your father and I have much to talk about, and we would rather discuss things while we're alone. The brothers nodded. They said goodbye to their mother and turned their horses around. The wind from the mountains blew cool and fresh against her hot cheeks as she came over the last sharp rise. The sun gilded the small gray buildings, which cast long shadows across the courtyard. The grain was just about to form ears up there. It stood so lovely in the small fields, glistening and swaying in the wind. Tall crimson fireweed in bloom fluttered from all the heaps of stones and up on the crags. Here and there the hay had been piled up in stacks. But there wasn't a trace of life on the farm, not even a dog to greet her or give warning. Kristen unsaddled her horse and led it over to the water trough. She didn't want to let it roam loose, so she took it over to the stable. The sun shone through a big hole in the roof. The sod hung in strips between the beams. And there was no sign that a horse had stood there for quite some time. Kristen tended to the animal and then went back out to the courtyard. She looked in the cowshed. It was dark and desolate. She could tell by the smell that it must have stood empty for a long time. Several animal hides were stretched out to dry on the wall of the house. A swarm of blue flies buzzed up into the air as she approached. Near the north gable, earth had been piled up and sod spread over it, so the timbers were completely hidden. He must have done that to keep in the heat. She fully expected the house to be locked, but the door opened when she touched the handle. Erland hadn't even latched the door to his dwelling. An unbearable stench met her as she stepped inside, the rank and pungent smell of hides and a stable. The first feeling that came over her as she stood in his house was a deep remorse and pity. This place seemed to her more like an animal's lair. Oh, yes, 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 Simon. You were right. It was a small house, but it had been beautifully and carefully built. The fireplace even had a brick chimney so that it wouldn't fill the room with smoke, as the hearth did in the high loft room back home. But when she tried to open the damper to air out the foul smell a bit, she saw that the chimney had been closed off with several flat rocks. The glass pane in the window facing the gallery was broken and stuffed with rags. The room had a wooden floor, but it was so filthy that the floorboards were barely visible. There were no cushions on the benches, but weapons, hides, and old clothing were strewn about everywhere. Scraps of food littered the dirty table, and the flies buzzed high and low. She gave a start and stood there trembling, unable to breathe, her heart pounding. In that bed over there, in the bed where that thing had lain when she was here last, something was lying there now, covered with a length of homespun. She wasn't sure what she thought. Then she clenched her teeth and forced herself to go over and lift up the cloth. It was only Erlon's armor, with his helmet and shield. They were lying on the bare boards of the bed, covered up. She glanced at the other bed. That's where they had found Björn and Osild. That's where Erlon now slept. No doubt she too would sleep there in the night. How must it have been for him to live in this house? To sleep here. Once again, all her other feelings were drowned in pity. She went over to the bed. It hadn't been cleaned in a long time. The straw under the hide sheet had been pressed down until it was quite hard. There was nothing else but a few sheepskin blankets and a couple of pillows covered with homespun, so filthy that they stank. Dust and dirt scattered as she touched the bedding. Erlon's bed was no better than that of a stable boy in a stall. Erlon, who could never have enough splendor around him. Erlon, who would put on silk shirts, velvet, and fine furs if he could find the slightest excuse to do so. Who resented having to let his children wear hand-woven homespun on workdays, and who had never liked it when she nursed them herself or lent her maids a hand with the housework. Like a leaseholder's wife, he said. Jesus. But he had brought this upon himself. No. I won't say a word. I will take back everything I said, Simon. You were right. He must not stay here. The father of my sons. I will offer him my hand and my lips and ask his forgiveness. This isn't easy, Simon. But you were right. She remembered his sharp gray eyes. His gaze just as steadfast, almost to the very end. In that wretched body which had begun to decay, his pure, bright spirit had shone from his eyes until his soul was drawn home, the way a blade is pulled back. She knew it was as Romborg had said. He had loved her all these years. Every single day in the months since his death, she couldn't help thinking about him. And now she saw that she had realized it even before Romborg spoke. During this time she had been forced to mull over all the memories she had of him, for as far back as she had known Simon Dara. In all these years she had carried false memories of this man, who had once been her betrothed. She had tampered with these memories the way a corrupt ruler tampers with the coin and mixes impure ore with the silver. When he released her and took upon himself the blame for the breach of promise, she told herself, and believed it, that Simon Andresen had turned away from her with contempt as soon as he realized that her honor had been disgraced. She had forgotten that when he let her go, on that day in the nun's garden, he was certainly not thinking that she was no longer innocent or pure, Even back then, he was willing to bear the shame for her inconstant and disobedient disposition. All he asked was that her father should be told that he was not the one who sought to break the agreement. And there was something else she now knew. When he had learned the worst about her, he stood up to redeem for her a scrap of honor in the eyes of the world. If she could have given her heart to him then, Simon would have still taken her as his wife before the church door, and he would have tried to live with her so she would never feel that he concealed a memory of her shame. But she still knew that she could never have loved him. She could never have loved Simon Andresen. And yet, everything that had enraged her about Erland because he didn't have particular traits, those were the traits that Simon did possess. But she was a pitiful woman who couldn't help complaining. Simon had given selflessly to the one he loved. No doubt she had believed that she did the same. But when she received his gifts, without thought or thanks, Simon had merely smiled. Now she realized that he had often been melancholy when they were together. She now knew that he had concealed sorrow behind his strangely impassive demeanor. Then he would toss out some impertinent jest and push it aside, as ready as ever to protect and to help and to give. She herself had raged, storing away and brooding over every grief, whenever she offered her gifts and Erland paid them no mind. Here in this very room, she had stood and pronounced such bold words. "I was the one who took the wrong path, and I won't complain about Erland even if it leads me out over the scree." That was what she had said to the woman whom she drove to her death in order to make room for her own love. Kristen moaned aloud, clasped her hands before her breast, and stood there, rocking back and forth. Yes, she had said so proudly that she would not complain about Erland Nikolausen if he grew tired of her, betrayed her, or even left her. Yes, but if that was what Erland had done, she thought she would have been able to stand it. If he had betrayed her once, and that had been the end of it. But he hadn't betrayed her. He had merely failed her again and again and made her life full of anguish and uncertainty. No, he had never betrayed her, nor had he ever made her feel secure. And she could see no end to it all. Here she stood now, about to beg him to come back, to fill her goblet each day with uncertainty and unrest, with expectations, with longings and fear and hope that would be shattered. She felt now as if he had worn her out. She had neither the youth nor the courage to live with him any longer, and she would probably never grow so old that Erland couldn't play with her heart. Not young enough to have the strength to live with him. Not old enough to have patience with him. She had become a miserable woman. No doubt that was what she had always been. Simon was right. Simon. And her father. They had held on to their loyal love for her, even as she trampled on them for the sake of this man whom she no longer had the strength to endure. Oh, Simon. I know that never for a minute did you wish vengeance upon me. But I wonder, Simon, if you know in your grave that now you have been avenged after all. No, she couldn't bear it any longer. She would have to find something to do. She made up the bed and looked for a dish rag and broom, but they were not to be found anywhere. She glanced into the alcove. Now she understood why it smelled like a stable. Erland had made a stall for his horse in there. But it had been mucked out and cleaned. His saddle and harness, which hung on the wall, were well cared for and oiled, with all the torn pieces mended. Compassion once more washed away all other thoughts. Did he keep Sultan inside, because he couldn't bear to be alone in the house? Kristen heard a sound out on the gallery. She stepped over to the window. It was covered with dust and cobwebs, but she thought she caught a glimpse of a woman. She pulled the rag from the hole and peeked out. A woman was setting down a pail of milk and a small cheese out there. She was middle-aged and lame and wore ugly, tattered clothes. Kristen herself was hardly aware of how much easier she breathed. She tidied up the room as best she could. She found the inscription that Bjørn Gunnarsson had carved into a timber of the wall. It was in Latin, so she couldn't decipher the whole thing, but he called himself both Dominus and Milus, and she read the name of his ancestral state in Elva County, which he had lost because of Osheild Gautusdottir. In the midst of the splendid carvings on the high seat was his coat of arms with its unicorn and water lilies. A short time later, Kristen heard a horse somewhere outside. She went over to the entryway and peered out. From the leafy forest across from the farm, a tall black stallion emerged, pulling a load of firewood. Erland walked alongside to guide him. A dog was perched on top of the wood, and several more dogs were running around the sled. Sultan, the Castilian, strained against the harness and pulled the sled full of wood across the grassy courtyard. One of the dogs began barking as it crossed the green. Erland, who had begun to unfasten the harnesses, noticed from all the dogs that something must be wrong. He took his axe from the load of wood and walked toward the house. Kristen fled back inside, letting the door fall shut behind her. She crept over to the fireplace and stood there, trembling and waiting. Erland stepped inside with his axe in hand and the dogs milling around him on the threshold. They found the intruder at once and began barking furiously. The first thing she noticed was the rush of blood that flooded his face, so youthful and red. The quick tremor on his fine, soft lips and his big, deep-set eyes beneath the shadow of his brows. The sight of him took her breath away. No doubt she saw the old stubble of beard on the lower half of his face, and she saw that his disheveled hair was iron gray. But the color that came and went so swiftly in his cheeks, the way it had when they were young. He was just as young and handsome. It was as if nothing had been able to break him. He was poorly clad. His blue shirt was filthy and tattered. Over it he wore a leather vest, scratched and scraped and torn around the eyelets. But it fit snugly and followed pliantly the graceful, strong movements of his body. His tight leather hose was torn at one knee, and the seam was split on the back of the other leg. And yet he had never looked more like the descendant of chieftains and noblemen than he did now. With such calm dignity, he carried his slender body with the wide, rather sloping shoulders and the long, elegant limbs. He stood there, his weight resting slightly on one foot, one hand stuck in the belt around his slim waist, the other holding the axe at his side. He had called the dogs back, and now he stood staring at her, turning red and pale and not saying a word. For a good long time, they both were silent. Finally, the man spoke, his voice a little uncertain. "So you've come here, Kristen?"
"I wanted to see how you were doing up here," she replied.
"Well, now you've seen it." He glanced around the room. "You can see that I'm tolerably comfortable here. It's good that you happened to come by on a day when everything was tidied up so nicely."
He noticed the shadow of a smile on her face.
"Or perhaps you're the one who has been cleaning up," he said, laughing softly.
Erland put down his axe and sat on the outer bench with his back leaning against the table. All of a sudden he grew somber.
"You're standing there, so there's nothing wrong back home, is there? At Jørungard, I mean? With the boys?"
"No." Now she had the chance to present her purpose. "Our sons are thriving and show great promise. But they long so much for you, Erlan. It was my intention. I've come here, husband, to ask you to return home to us. We all miss you."
She lowered her eyes. "You look well, Kristen."
Erlan gazed at her with a little smile. Kristen stood there, red-faced, as if he had struck a blow to her ear. "That's not why..."
No. I know it's not because you think you're too young and fresh to be left a widow.
Erlan said when she broke off.
I don't think any good would come of it if I returned home, Kristen.
He added in a more serious tone.
In your hands, everything is flourishing at Urengard. I know that. You have good fortune with all your undertakings. And I am quite content with my situation here.
The boys aren't happy that we are quarreling, she replied softly.
Oh.
Erland hesitated.
They're so young. I don't think they take it so hard that they won't forget about it when it's time for them to leave their childhood behind. I might as well tell you,
he added with a little smile,
that I see them from time to time.
She knew about this, but she felt humiliated by his words, and it seemed as if that was his intention, since he thought she didn't know. Her sons had never realized that she knew. But she replied somberly, then you also know that many things at Urengard are not as they should be.
We never talk about such matters, he said with the same smile. We go hunting together.
But you must be hungry and thirsty.
He jumped up. And here you stand.
No, sit down in the high seat, Kristen.
Yes, sit there, my dear. I won't crowd in next to you.
He brought in the milk and cheese and found some bread, butter, and dried meat. Kristen was hungry and quite thirsty, but she had trouble swallowing her food. Erland ate in a hasty and careless manner, as had always been his custom when not among guests, and he was soon finished. He talked about himself. The people who lived at the foot of the hill worked his land and brought him milk and a little food. Otherwise, he went into the mountains to hunt and fish. But then he mentioned that he was actually thinking about leaving the country to seek service with some foreign warlord.
Oh no, Erlan.
He gave her a swift, searching glance. But she said no more. The light was growing dim in the room. Her face and wimple shone white against the dark wall. Erlan stood up and stoked the fire in the hearth. Then he straddled the outer bench and turned to face her. The red glow of the fire flickered over his body. To think that he would even consider such a thing. He was almost as old as her father had been when he died. But it was all too likely that he would do it one day, take off on some whim, in search of new adventures.
Don't you think it's enough?
Said his wife heatedly. Enough that you fled the village, leaving me and your sons behind? Do you have to flee the country to leave us too?
If I'd known what you thought of me, Kristen, said Erland gravely, I would have left your estate much sooner. But I now see that you've had to bear a great deal because of me.
You know quite well, Erlan. You say my estate, but you have the rights of a husband over all that is mine.
She herself could hear how weak her voice sounded.
Yes, replied Erlan. But I know I was a poor master over what I owned myself.
He fell silent for a moment.
Nokva, I remember the time before he was born. And you spoke of the child you were carrying, who would take my high seat after me. I now see, Kristen, that it was hard for you. It's best if things stay as they are. And I'm content with my life up here.
Kristen shuddered as she glanced around at the room in the fading light. Shadows now filled every cranny, and the glow from the flames danced.
I don't understand, she said, on the verge of collapse, how you can bear this house. You have nothing to occupy your time, and you're all alone. I think you could at least take on a workman.
You mean that I should run the farm myself?
Erland laughed.
Oh no, Kristen. You know I'm ill-suited to be a farmer. I can never sit still.
Sit still. But surely you're sitting still here. During the long winter?
Erlan smiled to himself. His eyes had an odd, remote look to them.
Yes, in some sense you're right. When I don't have to think about anything but whatever happens to cross my mind and can come and go as I like. And you know that I've always been the kind of person who can fall asleep if there's nothing to keep watch over. I sleep like a hibernating bear whenever the weather isn't good enough to go into the mountains.
Aren't you ever afraid to be here alone? Whispered Kristen.
At first, he gave her a look of incomprehension. Then he laughed. Because people say this place is haunted. I've never noticed anything. Sometimes I've wished that my kinsman Bjorn would pay me a visit. Do you remember that he once said he didn't think I'd be able to stand to feel the edge of a blade at my throat? I'd like to tell him now that I wasn't particularly frightened when I had the rope around my neck.
A long shiver rippled through Kristen's body. She sat without saying a word. Erlund stood up.
It must be time for us to go to bed now, Kristen.
Stiff and cold, she watched Erlund remove the coverlet from his armor, spread it over the bed, and tuck it around the dirty pillows.
This is the best I have, he said.
Erlund. She clasped her hands under her breast. She searched for something to say, to win a little more time. She was so frightened. Then she remembered the promise she had made. Erlund, I have a message to give you. Simon asked me, when he was near the end, to bring you his greetings. Every single day he regretted the words he spoke to you when you last parted. Unmanly, he called them. And he asked you to forgive him.
Simon.
Erlund was standing with one hand on the bedpost. He lowered his eyes.
He's the one man I would least like to be reminded of.
I don't know what came between the two of you, said Kristen. She thought Erlund's words remarkably heartless. But it would be strange, and unlike Simon, if things were as he said, that he did not treat you justly. Surely he wasn't entirely to blame if this is true.
Erlund shook his head. He stood by me like a brother when I was in need, he said in a low voice. And I accepted his help and his friendship. And I never realized that it had always been difficult for him to tolerate me. It seems to me that it would have been easier to live in the old days, when two fellows like us could have fought a duel, meeting out on the islet to let the test of weapons decide who would win the fair maiden.
He picked up an old cape from the bench and slung it over his arm.
Perhaps you'd like to keep the dogs inside with you tonight?
Kristen had stood up. Where are you going, Erlund?
Out to the barn to sleep.
No. Erlund stopped, standing there slender and straight-backed and young in the red glow from the dying embers in the fireplace. I don't dare sleep alone in this room. I don't dare.
Do you dare sleep in my arms, then?
She caught a glimpse of his smile in the darkness, and she grew faint.
Aren't you afraid that I might crush you to death, Kristen?
If only you would. She fell into his arms. When she woke up, she could see from the window pane that it was daylight outdoors. Something was weighing down her breast. Erlund was sleeping with his head on her shoulder. He had placed his arm across her body and was gripping her left arm with his hand. She looked at her husband's iron gray hair. She looked at her own small, withered breasts. Above and below them, she could see the high, curved arch of her ribs under the thin covering of skin. A kind of terror seized hold of her as one memory after another from the night before rose up. In this room, the two of them at their age. Horror and shame overwhelmed her as she saw the patches of red on her worn mother arms, on her shriveled bosom. Abruptly, she grabbed the blanket to cover herself. Erlund awoke, raised himself up on one elbow, and stared down at her face. His eyes were coal black after his slumber.
I thought.
He threw himself down beside her again. A deep, wild tremor rushed through her at the sound of joy and anguish in his voice.
I thought I was dreaming again.
She opened her lips to his mouth and wrapped her arms around his neck. Never, never had it felt so blessed. Later that afternoon, when the sunshine was already golden and the shadows lay stretched out across the green courtyard,
They set off to get water from the creek. Erland was carrying the two large buckets. Kristen walked at his side, lithe, straight-backed, and slender. Her wimple had slipped back and lay around her shoulders. Her uncovered hair was a gleaming brown in the sun. She could feel it herself as she closed her eyes and lifted her face to the light. Her cheeks had turned red. The features of her face had softened. Each time she glanced over at him, she would lower her gaze, overwhelmed, when she saw in Erland's face how young she was. Erland decided that he wanted to bathe. As he walked farther down, Kristen sat on the thick carpet of grass, leaning her back against a rock. The murmuring and gurgling of the mountain stream lulled her into a doze. Now and then, when mosquitoes or flies touched her skin, she would open her eyes briefly and swat them away with her hand. Down among the willow thickets, near the deep pool, she caught sight of Erland's white body. He was standing with one foot up on a rock, scrubbing himself with tufts of grass. Then she closed her eyes again and smiled, weary but happy. She was just as powerless against him as ever. Her husband came back and threw himself down on the grass in front of her, his hair wet, his red lips cold from the water as he pressed them to her hand. He had shaved and put on a better shirt, although it was not particularly grand either. Laughing, he pointed to his armpit, where the fabric was torn.
"You could have brought me a shirt when you finally decided to come north."
"I'll start sewing a shirt for you as soon as I get home, Erlan," she replied with a smile, caressing his forehead with her hand. He grabbed hold of it.
"Never will you leave here again, my Kristen."
She merely smiled without replying. Erlan pushed himself away so that he could lie down on his stomach. Under the bushes, in a damp, shady spot, grew a cluster of small, white, star-shaped flowers. Their petals had blue veins like a woman's breast, and in the center of each blossom sat a tiny brownish-blue bud. Erlan picked every one of them.
"You, who are so clever about such things, Kristen, surely you must know what these flowers are called."
"They're called Phrygia grass." "No, Erlan." She blushed and pushed away his hand as he tried to slip the flowers into her bodice. Erlan laughed and gently bit the white petals, one after the other. Then he put all the flowers into her open hands and closed her fingers around them.
"Do you remember when we walked in the garden at Hofvin Hospice, and you gave me a rose?"
Kristen slowly shook her head as she gave him a little smile. "No, but you took a rose from my hand."
"And you let me take it, just as you let me take you, Kristen. As gentle and pious as a rose. Later on, you sometimes scratched me bloody, my sweet."
He flung himself into her lap and put his arms around her waist.
"Last night, Kristen, it did no good. You weren't allowed to sit there demurely and wait."
Kristen bent her head and hid her face against his shoulder. On the fourth day, they had taken refuge up in the birch woods among the foothills across from the farm, for on that day the tenant was bringing in the hay. Without discussing it, Kristen and Erland had agreed that no one needed to know that she was visiting him. He went down to the buildings a few times to get food and drink, but she stayed among the alpine birches, sitting in the heather. From where they sat, they could see the man and woman toiling to carry home the hay bundles on their backs.
"Do you remember?" asked Erlan. "The time you promised me that if I ended up on a smallholder's farm in the mountains, you would come and keep house for me? You wanted to have two cows and some sheep."
Kristen laughed a little and tugged at his hair. "What do you think our boys would think about that, Erlan, if their mother ran away and left them behind in that manner?"
"I think they would be happy to manage Jörungard on their own," said Erland, laughing. "They're old enough now. Gauta is a capable farmer, even as young as he is. And Nokva is almost a man."
"Oh, no." Kristen laughed softly. "It's probably true that he thinks so himself. Well, no doubt all five of them do. But he's still lacking a man's wisdom, that boy."
"If he takes after his father, It's possible that he might acquire it late, or perhaps never at all, replied Erlan. He gave a sly smile. You think you can hide your children under the hem of your cloak, Kristen? Nokfa fathered a son this summer. You didn't know about that, did you?
No. Kristen sat there, red-faced and horror-stricken.
Yes, it was stillborn. And the boy is apparently careful not to go over there anymore. It was the widow of Paul's son, here at Haugsbrecken. She said it was his, and I suppose he wasn't without blame, no matter how things stood. Yes, we're getting to be so old, you and I.
How can you talk that way after your son has brought upon himself such dishonor and trouble? It pierced her heart that her husband could speak so nonchalantly, and that it seemed to amuse him that she hadn't known anything about it.
Well, what do you want me to say? Asked Erland in the same tone of voice. The boy is 18 winters old. You can see for yourself that it does little good for you to treat your sons as if they were children. When you move up here with me, we'll have to see about finding him a wife.
Do you think it will be easy for us to find a suitable match for Nokfa? No, husband. After this, I think you must realize that you need to come back home with me and lend a hand with the boys. Vehemently, Erlan propped himself up on his elbow.
I won't do that, Kristen. I'm a stranger here and will always be one in your parish. No one remembers anything about me except that I was condemned as a traitor and betrayer of the king. Didn't you ever think, during the years I've lived here at Jurngard, that my presence was an uneasy one? Back home in Skaun, I was accustomed to a position of some importance among the people. Even during those days in my youth, when gossip flew about my evil ways and I was banned from the church, I was still Erlan Nikolausen of Husaby. Then came the time, Kristen, when I had the joy of showing the people of the northern regions that I was not entirely debased from the honor of my ancestors. No, I tell you. Here on this little farm, I'm a free man. No one glares at my footprints or talks behind my back. Do you hear me, Kristen? My only love. Stay with me. You will never have cause to regret it. Life here is better than it ever was at Husaby. I don't know why it is, Kristen, but I've never been so happy or lighthearted. Not as a child or ever since. It was hell while Elina lived with me at Husaby. And you and I were never truly happy together there either. And yet the Almighty God knows that I have loved you every hour and every day that I've known you. I think that manor was cursed. Mother was tormented to death there, and my father was always an unhappy man. But here life is good, Kristen. If only you would stay with me. Kristen, as truly as God died on the cross for us, I love you as much today as on that evening when you slept under my cape. The night of St. Margaretta's Day. I sat and looked at you. Such a pure and fresh and young and untouched flower you were.
Kristen said quietly, Do you remember, Erlan, that you prayed on that night that I would never weep a single tear for your sake?
Yes, and God and all the saints in heaven know that I meant it. It's true that things turned out differently, as surely they must. That's what always happens while we live in this world. But I loved you, both when I treated you badly and when I treated you well. Stay here, Kristen.
Haven't you ever thought that it would be difficult for our sons? She asked in the same quiet voice, to have people talk about their father, as you admit. All seven of them can't very well run off to the mountains to escape the parish gossip.
Erlund lowered his eyes. They're young. He said. Handsome and intrepid boys. They'll figure out how to make their own way. But the two of us, Kristen, we don't have many years left before we'll be old. Do you want to squander the time you have remaining when you were beautiful and healthy and meant to rejoice in life? Kristen.
She looked down to avoid the wild glint in his eyes. After a moment, she said, Have you forgotten, Erlan? The two of our sons are still children. What would you think of me if I left Lavrans and Munan behind?
Then you can bring them up here, unless Lavrans would rather stay with his brothers. He's not a little boy anymore. Is Munan still so handsome? He asked, smiling.
Yes, said Kristen. He's a lovely child.
Then they sat in silence for a long time. When they spoke again, it was of other matters. She woke up in the gray light of dawn the next day, as she had every morning up there. She lay in bed listening to the horses plodding around outside the house. She had her arms wrapped around Erlan's head. The other mornings, when she woke up in the early gray hour, she had been seized by the same anguish and shame as the first time. She had fought to subdue those feelings. The two of them were a married couple who had quarreled and now reconciled. Nothing could benefit the children more than that their father and mother became friends once again. But on this morning she lay there, struggling to remember her sons. For she felt as if she had been bewitched. Erland had spirited her away and brought her up here, straight from the woods of Gerdarud, where he had taken her into his arms the first time. They were so young. It couldn't be true that she had already borne this man 7 sons. She was the mother of tall, grown-up men. But she felt as if she had been lying here in his arms and merely dreamed about those long years they had spent together as husband and wife at Husaby. All his impetuous words resounded and enticed her. Dizzy with fear, she felt as if Erland had swept away her 7-fold burden of responsibility. This is the way it must feel when the young mare is unsaddled up in the mountain pasture. The packs and saddle and bridle are removed, and the wind and air of the mountain plateau stream against her. She is free to graze the fine grass on the heights, free to run as far as she likes across all the slopes. But at the same time she was already yearning, with a sweet and willing sense of longing, to bear a new burden. She was yearning with a faint, tender giddiness for the one who would now live nearest her heart for 9 long months. She had been certain of it from the first morning she woke up here in Erlan's arms. Her barrenness had left her, along with the harsh, dry, gasping heat in her heart. She was hiding Erlan's child in her womb, and with a strangely gentle feeling of impatience, her soul was reaching out toward the hour when the infant would be brought into the light. My big sons no longer need me, she thought. They think I'm unreasonable, that I nag them. We'll just be in their way, the little child and I. No, I can't leave here. We must stay here with Erlan. I can't leave. But when they sat down together to eat breakfast, she mentioned nevertheless that she would have to return home to her children. It was Lavrans and Munan she was thinking of. They were old enough now that she was embarrassed to imagine them living up here with Erland and herself, perhaps looking with astonishment at their parents who had become so youthful. But those two couldn't be without her. Erland sat and stared at her as she talked about going home. At last he gave her a fleeting smile. Well, if that's what you want, then you must go. He wanted to accompany her for part of the journey. He rode all the way through Roast Gorge and up to Seal, until they could see a little of the church roof above the tops of the spruce trees. Then he said goodbye. He smiled to the very end, slyly confident. You know now, Kristen, that whether you come at night or by day, whether I have to wait for you a short time or a long time, I will welcome you as if you were the Queen of Heaven come down from the clouds to my farm. She laughed.
I don't dare speak as grandly as that. But you must now realize, my love, that there will be great joy at your manor on the day the Master returns to his own home.
He shook his head and chuckled. Smiling, they took leave of each other. Smiling, Erland leaned over as they sat on their horses, side by side, and kissed her many times, and between each kiss, he looked at her with his laughing eyes. So we'll see, he said finally, which of us is more stubborn, my fair Kristen. This is not the last time we will meet. You and I both know that. As she rode past the church, she gave a little shudder. She felt as if she were returning home from inside the mountain, as if Erland were the mountain king himself, and could not come past the church and the cross on the hill. She pulled in the reins. She had a great urge to turn around and ride after him. Then she looked out across the green slopes, down at her beautiful estate.